The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmn.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Treasury of the True Dharma. Nanquan in the land deity. Zen Master Puwan of Mount Nanquan, whose family name was Wang, once visited a village. For this occasion, the village leader had made arrangements to welcome him beforehand. Nanquan said, "Usually my coming and going is not known about by others. How is it that you knew of my coming and prepared for it like this?" The village leader said, "Last night the deity of this land told us you were coming." Nanquan said, "Master Wang has not practiced hard enough and was seen by a spirit." His attendant said, "You're a master of great knowledge. Why is it that you were noticed by a spirit?" Nanquan said, "Offer a bowl of rice to the land deity." Laroche's comments. It seems that old Nanquan's transparency has failed. Deities and spirits follow his wake and know his every move. Haven't you heard the saying, however many wise ones and sages have entered these mountains, no one has ever seen a single one of them. There's only the activity of the mountain. Adepts are usually tested using the three essential seals of sealing mud, sealing water, and sealing space. If you're noticed by deities and spirits who do not practice, it means that your own practice is still not strong enough. But the question remains, what does the offering of rice have to do with alleviating Nanquan's problem? And indeed, what does Nanquan mean when he says, Master Wang has not practiced hard enough? This poem. In the whole body and mind, seeing and hearing, there is intimacy. In this continuum, no trace of self remains, and this tracelessness continues endlessly. I've always thought this an interesting koan. Nanquan, of course, was Master Zhaozhou's teacher, 8th, early 9th century, China, disciple of Matsu. One day he was teaching, and he said, "Why is it that phenomenal existence is empty? If there's nothing within mind, then how does one explain how the myriad things arise? Isn't it as if shadowy forms differentiates emptiness? This question is like someone grasping sound and placing it in a box, or blowing into a net to fill it with air. If all things are empty of any inherent existence, then how do things come into being?" It's a reasonable question. It's kind of an essential question. In the Prajnaparamita Sutra, a disciple of the Buddha asked the Buddha the same question. If all is empty, why are there various realms of existence that human beings and all kinds of creatures move through? And the Buddha said, those who think and speak and act out of their kleshas, their afflictive emotions, and experiencing the result of those actions will reproduce themselves in those various realms of existence. In other words, they will create themselves in those various realms of existence as a result of those very actions. Those actions, those kleshas, too, are empty of any inherent existence. So all the phenomena, the six realms of existence, all fundamentally have no power of their own, and yet, here they are. Nanquan said, usually my coming and going is not known about by others. How did the land deity know? So this is a basic teaching that in coming, in birth, no person is born. In death, no person, no self is extinguished. And there is a baby that enters the world, and there is a person who has passed from this life. Those are happening at the same moment in perfect unity, perfect harmony. But here, Nanquan sees this as an indication that his practice is not strong enough. Why is it that if existence is empty, how we explain the coming of the many things? At the end of that comment that he made to the Sangha, he said this question, like someone placing sound in a box, blowing into a net to fill it with air. This is why an old master said, it's not mind, it's not Buddha, it's not a thing. And because of this, we just teach students to go on a journey. Because of this, for one who wants to know, we have to go on a journey. We call that the path. We have to find out for ourselves. We call that practice and training. So what is this deity that knew about the every moment movement of Master Nanquan? What are we to make of this? These deities and different beings populate Buddhist literature going back to the beginning. In the Lotus Sutra, at the beginning of the Mahayana Sutras, there is usually a kind of a roll call of everyone who's in attendance. And it's usually a very, very long list and a very varied list. Beginning of the Lotus Sutra, there were monastics, monks and nuns, bodhisattvas, Indra king of gods, multiple gods, children of gods, dragon rulers, Kinara and Garuda beings, half human, half bird, Gandharva beings, divine musicians, dancers, performers, there are earth, air, fire, and water deities. When we do Wariyoki, we chant that this ambrosia water with which we've washed our bowls, we offer it to the various spirits to satisfy them. We do an akursan service. We used to do it once every, once a week. And it's a service to the protectors and guardians of the temple. Kursan is white dragon. And at different times over the years, I remember there was a period where there were a couple of car accidents with people driving monastery cars. And so Dado said, do more of those. And during COVID, I think it was when we started doing it. Was that when we started doing it every day? Yeah. We started doing it every day when COVID struck, thought that was a good idea. And then it was like, now it's kind of hard to, we're going to go back to once a week? The roof might fall in. So these guardians, protectors, what are they? Who are they? Who does Nanquan want to make an offering to this land deity? What do we make of these many beings? Some believe in them as existing in time and space. Probably for most of human history, the world has been populated by many kinds of beings. But now we're modern. We have science to explain earthquakes and storms and droughts and famines and misfortune, good fortune. Some see these deities in Buddhism as aspects of oneself. Just different ways of looking at aspects of oneself. Some people just discount it altogether. It's just ancient mumbo-jumbo. Scholars talk about in religious teachings, aspects of teachings that are intended, that are pointing to reality, that are intended to be taken at face value, literally. This is talking about the way things work. And other teachings that are very expressly intended not to be understood that way. To be understood as inspirational, as metaphorical, as helping us to see and understand something, but not to be taken literally. And that we shouldn't confuse the two. Someone might attach to only what they can see and touch, only what can be verified through direct experience, through perception, what can be weighed and measured, to discard anything that we haven't experienced ourselves. Right? Well, that would basically rule out Dharma practice. It would rule out a lot of things. Right. But Dada Roshi says Nanquan seems to take this being seen by the land deity to heart. And in fact, he says, Master Wang, referring to himself, has not practiced hard enough and was seen by this spirit. And Dada Roshi said, haven't you heard the saying, Dogen? However many wise ones and sages have entered these mountains, no one has ever seen a single one of them. There is only the activity of the mountain. And so we can think of the self-clinging self, as leaving a trail. Right? We leave a kind of trail of residue behind us. In training, when a student is taking on some responsibility for training someone else, service positions, zendo positions, and so on, when I talk to them, I will often say, look, you know, before you go in and just basically give someone more instruction, know your mind, know where you're at, know what you're bringing into that interaction, and try and just bring in what the message that needs to be communicated, such that when you leave, that person is left with the message. The message has been delivered. And you don't leave residue of yourself. Your irritation, your impatience, your desire to be liked, and so be overly desiring that this should be a really wonderful interchange. One's arrogance. Leave no trace. But leaving no trace can be another trace. There's the story of the tea master. Rikyu, who was going to serve tea to a big, powerful warlord. And so I think it's something like this. And so he had his attendant, it was fall, and he had his attendant rake all the leaves that were filling the garden to clean it up. And then right before the warrior was to come, Rikyu went out and shook one of the trees. So some of the leaves fell. Leaving no trace at all can be just another trace. When there's no hindrance in the mind, then the one receiving the instruction is left just with the instruction. And so that's a part of training, right? To be able to simply receive instruction, right? There's something I'm doing that is new. It has certain instruction. I need to learn how to do it. I'm going to practice doing it. It's not going to be perfect. I'm going to receive corrective instruction. Can I do that? Can I receive this? If I'm resistant to that, is it because the person who's communicating it is bringing something of themselves that I find irritating? Is it because I just don't like being told what to do? Is it a little of both? Worth knowing. Of course, there are those who want to leave a trace, a big fat trace. They want the Noral to know that they are here. And that usually is not a good thing. Those who really want to do good usually understand on some level that it's not about them. That is the good they want to do. But in a world where being big, I was reading a short article, I read a little bit of a longer article about who's the real rich guy who's getting married in Venice. Yeah. And there was in one of the piazzas, somebody laid out a huge banner that said, if you're rich enough to rent Venice for a wedding, you can pay more taxes. And I just thought about in worlds within worlds, the world of gods, which I don't know much about. In such worlds, is there a place for loving kindness, for gentleness, for simplicity, for humility, for patience, for selflessness? Are those just naive? Are they considered just naive, only for the foolish? We had a student who, have a student who worked for Mercedes-Benz when it was a German-owned company. And then it was bought up, was merged with Daimler Chrysler. He was moved to LA or to California. And I said, how did that work? He said, the atmosphere changed overnight. It just became an American company. And he talked about how the sort of obsessive nature of the work just infiltrated everything that they did. Everything became hyper measured and competitive. And basically the credo, he said the basic ethos was, if you go out for lunch, you're lunch. Somebody's eating you while you go out to lunch. And so then what happens to these really essential virtues? Not just because they're enlightened virtues, but they're just basically decent virtues. The virtues of just being a decent human being, a good human being. What happens when those become naive or foolish or even dangerous? And all the while, Dogen says, the wise ones and sages enter into the mountains will never be seen. They don't leave a trace. And it's not because of some false humility, it's because they've realized there is no self to put forward. There is only what is to be done, and that which is to be done for the benefit of others. So what did Nan Kuan mean when he said, old Master Wang has not practiced hard enough and was seen by a spirit? Dadroshi says, there must be tracks for the spirit to take notice. We might say Nan Kuan almost doesn't lose himself. But is this a matter of being insufficient in his realization? And so he says, haven't practiced hard enough? Or is this him manifesting the Dharma body in vast space? The self that seems to come and go. In one moment, there's only the breath. In next moment, someone is breathing. In one moment, there's just sensation. In this next moment, you feel something. That sense of self seems to come and go. As Nan Kuan said, it's like a shadowy form. And it is shadowy, right? It's not a thing. You can't touch it. You can't put it in a box. It's not mind, it's not Buddha, it's not thing. And so the practice is to not be deceived, to not be taken in, to not be seduced by that as though it's something. I talked about earlier this week that nothing has inherent existence means no thought, no emotion, no sensation, no words from another. More poignantly, no action of another, in and of itself, has the power to hurt you. And yet we are hurt. Buddhism acknowledges and affirms both of those and says they are one reality, and we train in both of those realities, what we call the relative and the absolute, and understand how they are happening all the time, at the same time, in everything. So the attendant wants to know, you're a master of great knowledge. How is it that you were noticed by a spirit? And Nan Kuan says, offer a bowl of rice to the land deity. So again, we haven't really resolved. What do you make of these deities? Right? What do you do with those when you encounter them in the teachings, in a teaching like this, in our own liturgy? Are they real? Are they unreal? Should we take them seriously? Should we take them metaphorically? Should we just ignore them? The six realms of existence, hell realm, hungry ghost, animal realm, human realm, angry god, highest gods. We can clearly look at those as states of mind and body and emotion, states that we live in, sometimes pass through in the course of a day. Usually we, you know, have a more permanent address in one of those realms more than another. And that can become our identity. I am a hell being. I am a hungry ghost being. But if Nanquan was concerned about his own practice and wanted to do something about it, why didn't he offer the bowl of rice? Right? If my mind is distracted, I can't say, could you practice Zazen for me for a minute, please? Why didn't he offer the bowl if he was trying to close the gap? Why did he have his attendant? Bodhidharma said, revere your true nature. Respect it. Respect your true nature, that you possess true nature. In Buddhism, that's actually important. Not just that we possess it, but that we be developing, in a sense, a proper relationship with our true nature, because that's your life. And we do that through the personal self, the karmic self, all the ways in which the conditioned self arises, because they're not separate. And so Bodhidharma said, revere your true nature and humble your delusions. I like that. Humble those delusions. Let them be more humble. Not so outspoken, not so loud, not so controlling, not so powerful. Then Bodhidharma went on to say, Buddha wanted us to use reverence to express humility. So we do prostrations, we express gratitude. We express reverence to bring forth our humility and to calm the mind. He said to prostrate the body to show reverence, to harmonize inside and outside. And to think of the prostration as harmonizing inside and outside. We're bowing to something, to someone. Is that real or unreal? Is that person real or unreal? There's a story of Milarepa, the great yogi, who was out collecting firewood one day, and he came back to his cave, and he was startled to find five Indian demons in his cave. They have huge eyes. One of them was giving a talk, sitting on Milarepa's bed. Two were listening to the talk. One was preparing food as an offering, and the other was going through Milarepa's books. And Milarepa thought, well, these must be magical apparitions of local deities who are not happy with me. Maybe I didn't make offerings to them, didn't appease them. So he sang a song to the deities, and that just got them more upset. They stared at him. Two of them advanced, grimacing, biting their lower lips. One of them ground their teeth horribly, started making all kinds of noises. One came up behind and started laughing in a really demonic way, scaring him. They were all trying to frighten him. He said, Milarepa, knowing their evil motives, began to do a meditation for the wrathful Buddha, the fierce, protective Buddha. But they wouldn't have it. They weren't appeased. And so then he brought forth great compassion. And he gave a talk on great compassion, cultivating compassion. They didn't care about that either. And then finally Milarepa said, through the mercy of Marpa, his teacher, through the teachings of my teacher, I've already realized that all beings and all phenomena are one's own mind. The mind itself is a transparency of emptiness. What therefore is the use of all of this that I'm doing? How foolish I am to try and dispel these manifestations physically. And then he sang them a song of realization. And at the end he said, I, Milarepa, I fear neither demons nor evils. If they frighten Milarepa, then of what use is my realization? If I'm frightened by these apparitions of my own mind. You ghosts and demons, enemies of the Dharma, I welcome you today. It is my pleasure to receive you. I pray to you, stay. Don't be in a hurry to leave. Let's talk and play together. Although you would go because it's nighttime, I really want you to stay. Let's set up good against evil and see who plays the best. Before you came, you vowed to afflict me. I would be ashamed if you left not having fulfilled your vow. And then he rose up with confidence and rushed towards him. And they frightened, shrank, rolled their eyes in despair, trembled, swirled together into a whirlpool, and vanished. And this is Milarepa's own song of his own experience. What are we to make of it, this great being? What are we to make of the Buddha saying that in his enlightenment, he saw into all of his past lives, that he could see into all of the consequences of karmic actions? It's kind of unfathomable, right? It's hard to conceive that any human being could have such an experience, a direct experience, into the reality, not just of this moment, but of this moment that is containing time and space and beings. And so what do we do with that? You know, when we encounter these teachings, we have now encountered them. So as practitioners, how do we hold that? Do we take it literally? Do we take it metaphorically? Do we just disregard it? Do we consider the possibility of things that I do not yet know? Possibilities of mind, of enlightenment itself, of the depth of one's, of the Buddhas, and you know, in traditional Buddhism, a Buddha only comes around, you know, not very often. We talk about, you know, we're all Buddhas, everyone has Buddha nature, and that's true. And at the same time, we're using that term very, in a way, generously. But a Buddha, someone who is completely realized within Buddhist teaching, only happens, you know, rarely. And so, is it possible that this person had that depth of realization, right? I remember when I first encountered that, I just thought, that just seems highly unlikely, right? I mean, it's like, right? And I didn't stop to think, because that is so outside of my experience, I can't even imagine how that could be true. I just thought, that just doesn't seem possible. And that was enough of an inquiry for me at the time. But the more I trained and the more I just saw simple, ordinary changes within myself, but things that before I would not have imagined, the more that I studied the Buddha's teaching and began to more and more appreciate the depth, the profundity of his realization, of his understanding, see how it gets sort of played out in modern science, right? That this human being 2,500 years ago had insight into experientially, which science doesn't do, not in terms of the person's actual experience. It just gave me pause, right? I don't know. I don't know what's possible, actually. That's what I know. I don't know what's possible within myself. I don't know what's possible within you. I don't know what was possible for the Buddha. Can we hold something like that? So I'm going to be heading towards New Zealand tomorrow. You know, as many of you know, we have a sangha there, very active, vibrant, beautiful, down-under sangha, who is a result of one person, basically, who was a New Zealander, Kiwi, came here many years ago in the mid-80s, started practicing, came back again, which was not an easy thing for him to do. He was a musician. He taught at a university. Every time he came here for an extended period of time, he kind of had to dismantle his life and come here for that period of time and then go back home and reassemble his life. But he was a well-known musician, and he had the mojo and the street cred to do that. And he was so determined and so committed to the Dharma and began asking Dada Roshi if he would come to New Zealand to do sessions and teach. And Dada Roshi, who never really loved to travel, said okay and went. And I accompanied him on that first trip in 1988, and then basically we've been going every year since, except 1 or 2 years during COVID, when we did everything, but we did it online. And I made a promise in advance that if we were going to do that again, I would do it on their time frame. I did regret that, at least somewhat. I was glad, I wanted to do it, but it was hard switching to their time because they're on a different time. And so that one student who, because of his love for the Dharma, and then took it back home and, of course, wanted to have somebody to sit with, and so sitting groups began, and there was just a core group of people who were, you know, shakers and doers, and they just brought this Sangha into being. And it's continued over all this time. So I go down in July, and Hogen Sensei goes down in January. Hogen Sensei used to go, and as we get older, other teachers will go. And do the Dharma there with them. And so it's a long trip. It's a good trip. They are utterly worthy of all of that, and give back much in return. And there's another way in which it's helpful, which is for me personally. Is not just my own benefit, how I learn from them and enriched by that experience, but that for me to go away is a good thing. You know, Dada Roshi, years ago, before any of us wanted to think about or even hear him talk about it, was preparing for the time when he would not be here. And of course, he didn't know when that was going to happen. So he wanted to be ready. And he wanted to have things in place so that if he died unexpectedly, this would continue. We would continue. The Sangha would continue. He used to say no one in the Sangha should be indispensable, you know, which is not a cold, uncaring thing. It's saying the Sangha is important and the training is important. So it shouldn't get set up so that if one person is missing, the whole thing comes apart. Right? Something is then not being taken care of. The Sangha is not being taken care of. So he was really good at really thinking about that in advance and putting things into place. He even had what he called the Queeg Clause. Remember Captain Queeg from the Kane Mutiny, who went a little crazy and had bad consequences. Dada Roshi's mother had dementia. And so as he got older, he thought, what if he gets dementia? And people just think he's just doing Zen teaching, you know? And so what would happen? And at that point, he thought his students, those of us who were close to him, would probably not be able or willing to sort of acknowledge that and take action. And so he asked his Dharma siblings that we would contact them and they would come and assess the situation. And if he was really unfit for that role, that they would help to make that transition. And I remember him talking about that stuff, and we were just like, my, you know? Like, I don't even want to think about that. What if he died before he had any successors? He made provisions for that. And so, and we have done the same. I have done the same, right? Not because he was planning on dying anytime soon. Of course, nobody does, right? But it's a way of taking care of the people you love. It's a way of taking care of the Dharma. And so I don't know if it's a good idea to say all this right before I get on the plane and go. But I've been thinking about it. In fact, I have letters to all of the teachers and the board that begins, if you are reading this, it's because, And so that it's a way of expressing just my thoughts and feelings about what you might want to consider now, what might happen next. Dada Roshi's death took time because he was diagnosed with an illness. So we had that very, very precious time to be able to have those conversations while he was alive. So those letters are in case, you know, happens in a different way. So, I mean, you know, driving to Kingston is probably statistically as dangerous as getting on a plane going. But it's just the nature of it. You think about these things, you know. I remember the Dalai Lama once saying that when his time came to die, that he felt confident that he, because of his training, he would be able to really bring forth, you know, an intention and vows and wishes for great compassion that he'd be extending to all beings. At the time of his death, he would be giving his death away for the well-being of all people. But he said, but I don't know if I'm on a plane and it just goes down. I don't know. And I thought, thank you for that honest answer. I have every hope of seeing you again. But the other reason why it's important is, I kind of got off track, is to help to nurture the next generation, right? When I'm here, just because of my role, right, I have a role, and so when I'm here, I fulfill that role, right? When I'm not here, other people, teachers, monastics, seniors, have to step in varying degrees, and take that role. And that's an important thing to do. It's training. You're learning how, just like I learned, how to step into various roles and responsibilities and to feel that. You know, because when my teacher was here, you know, I felt him in that place. I was just sort of standing along helping. But when he wasn't here, it was like, oh. So when he sent me to New Zealand the first time without him, or he sent me to Greenhaven Prison without him when he stopped going, it was like, okay, I now somehow have to hold this. That's a different kind of experience that we train for, and in another sense, you can't prepare for. I guess it's kind of like being a parent. You can know a lot about in advance about what it might be like to be a parent, but I'm imagining when that child comes, it's a whole nother ballgame. Right? And you're both prepared and unprepared at the same time. It's similar. And so it's important to step away, to create that space so that that can happen. So. And it's wonderful to step away, whether it's for a week's vacation or when I go on solitary retreat or when I go away for weeks at a time, to know, to feel complete trust and confidence that all is well. And to have no doubt about the Sangha's capacity to train and to continue practicing, that it does not depend on any one person. That's why we eat and digest the Dharma. Right, and let it assimilate through our very being, that we engage these vows and incorporate them so that we live them. Right, that's how we take care of the Dharma. So I'll just end with a poem. Mountain summer, this mountain summer, is like no other. Life abounds, senses filled to brimming. For those who are free of time and worry, let the trees and clouds draw you in. Songbirds and rushing water are singing to you of perfect abiding. Here, don't fret over faults and cracks, for time is too swiftly passing by. Too many lives lie desolate here. At the end of this life, we will meet the imperative for ourselves, and know what has always been essential. What is this? You, please, add the last line.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.